Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is The Guardian.
A longer process, both for sustainable ceasefire, which would require Hamas to have no role, and progress towards a two-state solution, are all required for peace. And the point I would make, because sometimes the debate here in Australia operates as if we can resolve this, our role in this is to use our diplomatic and political voice. That is what Australia can do. We are not a party to the conflict. We are not of the region, but we can work with others as we have.
Hi, I'm Karen Middleton, Guardian Australia's political editor, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. I'm really pleased to be joining the Canberra team and bringing you conversations on the Australian Politics podcast. In the first of those today, I'm joined by Minister for Foreign Affairs, Penny Wong. We know many Australians were already feeling very deeply the impact of the ongoing conflict in Gaza, but this week has reinforced that in a devastating way, with the deaths of 7 international aid workers, including an Australian, when Israeli missiles struck their convoy. Penny Wong has called for accountability and says Israel should change course. But what does that mean exactly? How can Australia guarantee an investigation delivers both truth and consequences? And in pressing for a sustainable ceasefire, who makes the first move? I'm also keen for a readout on relations with China and to ask what role her own heritage plays there after that frenzied few days recently hosting the Chinese Foreign Minister and then the British Foreign and Defence Secretaries, who seem to have a new interest in the Pacific. And on the domestic front, there's the delayed detention bill and its potential impact on diplomacy. In amongst all that, she got married. It's a lot. Minister, thanks so much for being here, and special thanks for being here on my first time in the chair for the Australian Politics podcast at Guardian Australia. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's good to be with you, although obviously in very sad circumstances, but can I congratulate you on taking on this role? It's a really important contribution to, I think, the public and to the media landscape to have a longer form discussion like this.
Well, so thank you, and I appreciate it.
Even though you're probably going to be quite hard on me, short now, to say something nice up front.
We will see. The circumstances are unfortunate, as you said, and I think that's where we need to start here, this conversation today, and that's with the death of Australian aid workers, Omi Francombe, and 6 of her colleagues in Gaza this week. I think I'll note for the sake of those who are listening to us that we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, and of course things are moving fast on this issue, so there may be changes by the time they hear this. But I suppose what I want to ask you first up is what do we know so far about what actually happened here? Where are we up to with an investigation and with actual facts?
I'd like to start, if you don't mind, by just honouring the life of Omi Francombe, who, as you know, was one of that extraordinary breed of people who goes into conflict zones to ensure that fellow human beings' suffering is alleviated. And her death should never have happened. The death of any aid worker is outrageous and it is unacceptable. And I want to honour her life here and to honour all of those aid workers who do such extraordinary work in these circumstances. This has been a very dangerous conflict for aid workers. I think nearly 200 have been killed, and that's not acceptable. In terms of facts, and I appreciate the way you framed the question, because there's obviously been a lot of speculation, there's been a lot of opinions, a lot of theories, a lot of people saying things. The most important thing from the government's perspective is for there to be a thorough and transparent inquiry and for there to be full accountability as a consequence of any findings that are made.
Well, what does a thorough and transparent inquiry look like, though?
Well, we will be coordinating, we will be engaging with other like-minded countries about that, and we will be pressing the Israelis for the most thorough process that we are able. And that goes to what happened, how did this happen, what information did people have, why was the attack proceeded with. I mean, there are so many questions and they require clear answers.
And have you established any answers to any of those questions yet?
No, but and we can't. That's, you know, we are not... We are not able to do that from here. What we can do is continue to push for a transparent, thorough investigation with the Israelis. That was the subject of the very first call I made on the day the news of Zomi's death and her colleague's death broke, when I spoke to the Foreign Minister of Israel, Foreign Minister Katz, and it is the same that the Prime Minister has pressed with Prime Minister Netanyahu.
You've talked about transparency in this inquiry, but this presupposes that Israel is conducting the inquiry. Now, how much confidence can you have if Israel is conducting the inquiry? Do we not need an independent third party to investigate?
Well, look, I think a lot of that is opinion about which I probably don't want to be drawn on. What I will say, whatever form it takes, our principled position is a demand for transparency, thoroughness and full accountability upon conclusion.
Well, what does
What I would say to you is the same assurance I gave to Zomi's family. We will continue. This is not a set and forget. We will continue to engage. As you said, it's not our inquiry, but we will engage with other parties. And obviously, there were other foreign nationals who were also killed in this attack. And we will engage with the Israelis with those objectives in mind.
And a Palestinian citizen who was working with them too.
Correct.
Course, yeah. Zomi Frankham's family wants a war crimes investigation. I know you've spoken to them. What's your view of a war crimes investigation? Is that also necessary? Is that a parallel process?
Well, I think that our priority is to ensure that we find out what the facts are. And that is what we are pressing for the Israelis, to ensure that this investigation be transparent and thorough, and that then questions of accountability can be considered. I would say I do believe that the deaths of Zomi Frankholm and her colleagues was unacceptable. We know aid workers are protected under international humanitarian law. And we are also very clear that this incident is not an isolated one. We have, as I said, 196 already have been killed in this conflict. And the principle is these workers are protected. And we again remind the Netanyahu government that humanitarian workers are protected under international humanitarian law, and Israel has an obligation to ensure they are protected.
I want to come to your point about accountability in a minute, but to this point about 196, this has happened before. The Israeli government, via its spokesman, Avi Heiman, has said that this was a grave mistake. That was the phrase that he has used. But what we do know is that aid organisations lodge their detailed movement plans in advance with the Israeli Defence Force. They get approval for those plans before they move. We know that drone technology, which is what we understand was used here, is very precise, that the vehicles were very clearly marked, that three separate vehicles were hit, that the World's Central Kitchen staff were contacting the IDF to try and raise the alarm in between. There were hundreds of metres in between them when they were hit. Given all of that, what is your response to the description of it as a grave mistake, given it's happened before and it seems to keep on happening? Is that an adequate preliminary response from the Israeli government?
Well, this should not have happened full stop. And we look to the Israeli Defence Force and its government to provide all details about why this happened and how this could have happened, and for there to be full accountability.
Earlier this week, Juliette Toomer from the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine, UNRWA, we call it, was on Australian radio talking about this. And she was suggesting that those plans that are lodged by aid organisations include the name and nationality of those aid workers in the convoy. Have we established whether Israel knew the names and nationalities? And does that add any more significance to the concern?
Well, I think the concern is already at the highest level. Yeah, I mean, you're asking me facts which are not my facts. They're facts which are known to the NGOs and to the Israeli Defence Force. They're not, the Australian government doesn't have visibility of those facts or those arrangements or what happened. We don't have visibility, but we want transparency. But I want to make the broader point, which is whatever is said, whether, you know, whatever explanation people have, I think we start with a very clear position. This should not have happened.
The Israeli government has said a few things that do sound a little bit contradictory. They are calling it a mistake, but both Prime Minister Netanyahu and his spokesman have said words to the effect of these things happen in war, war is
hell. Yeah, I find that statement, I think it is, frankly, for the family in particular, pretty insensitive, deeply insensitive thing to say.
Well, it sounds like...
And what I'd say is the Australian Foreign Minister is we do not accept that explanation. We do not accept any suggestion that this can be brushed aside as just something that happens in war. The international community have signed up to the Geneva Conventions, including Israel, and that which sets out the principles of international humanitarian law, which are binding on states. Even in times of war, even in war, there are rules, and they include the principles of distinction between a military target and a civilian target, and they include a positive right, a right for there to be rapid and unimpeded passage for humanitarian workers.
The Israeli government spokesman has also said, oh, well, it happened in the dark. It was confusing. I mean, is there a daylight, nighttime caveat on these rules?
No, precisely. These rules are agreed by the international community, the Geneva Conventions, and Israel is bound by them. So we do not accept that these events, this attack on an aid convoy, can be dismissed or lessened, or diminished in any way at all.
And where things seem to me to be very contradictory is, on the one hand, we are hearing the Israeli government say it was a mistake and also these things happen. But on the other hand, when pressed, the Israeli government spokesman says, oh, well, sometimes Hamas terrorists hide in these convoys, you know, which suggests that for all the information they gather under these arrangements, which we call deconfliction arrangements with aid organisations, so they are supposed to be able to travel safely, it sounds like the Israeli government doesn't always believe them and responds accordingly. How isn't that a contradiction?
I can't speak for the Israeli government.
Sure, but does it concern you that they say, well, sometimes there are terrorists and we, you know, the implication being, well, we have to act? Does that not sound contradictory?
Well, I think that more importantly, what I will continue to say is whatever the facts on the ground, there are obligations upon Israel as a state. There are obligations upon Israeli commanders and military personnel individually under our international law and international humanitarian law. And Australia's principal position since the beginning of this conflict has been to call for the observance of international law, just as we continue to call for the release of hostages by Hamas.
Yeah, and I want to come to that too. So what is the point in having these deconfliction arrangements, these pre-approval arrangements with aid organisations, if the Israeli government is going to make its own decision, or the Defence Force is going to make its own decision on whether they accept the information or not? Doesn't that make those arrangements basically worthless?
It is the Israeli government's responsibility to ensure it has arrangements in place to enable compliance observance with international humanitarian law and
the
protection of aid workers.
Is Australia and the international community putting any specific requirements about improving those arrangements?
Well, I think you've seen the UN Security Council has made its view clear. There is no higher authority, certainly in the UN system, than the Security Council. And we have also seen the ICJ last week make a similar decision to the resolution of the Security Council, which required Israel to allow the provision of humanitarian assistance at scale. And what we would say to Israel is you are obliged to act in accordance with those decisions.
I want to come back to this point about accountability. You and the Prime Minister both keep mentioning that Israel must be held accountable. But what does accountability look like? The Prime Minister's been asked about it and he said it means finding out what happened. But surely it's more than that. Does someone need to be charged if this was found to have been
Karen, I understand why you're asking me that question, but you wouldn't expect me to jump ahead that far. I think accountability means we find out what happened and that whatever steps are necessary as a consequence are taken. And I'm not going to, there are a whole range of people who've been happy to jump into this and put their views. I don't think governments have to deal with facts and governments have to deal with international law, and that's what we'll do.
Well, let me ask you this. What teeth do we have behind our demand for accountability? When there are allegations made against UNRWA, the UN agency that we spoke about before, we suspended $6 million in aid that we had in the pipeline. We've now resumed that. But what are we doing in this case to ensure accountability other than just asking for it? I know we don't sell weapons to Israel. We do sell components. Do we suspend the sale of components? Is there something that we can use to enforce accountability?
Well, I'm not going to be drawn into speculation about what. I think the most important thing now is to ensure there is a proper investigation. And that's what our focus is. And then we will consider the facts when they have been identified. And then we will make decisions about what next steps might or might not be.
Is there a timeline for that investigation from your point of view?
Well, I think it's reasonable to expect it to be expeditious. I'm sure it will take far longer than the family wish, of course, far longer than I'm sure that the family and her friends would want, Zomi's friends would want answers today. But we also know that we need to do this properly and transparently. And we need to do it expeditiously.
And on this conflict more broadly, you've spoken about Israel needing to change course. What does that mean? I know you've advocated for a ceasefire, but let's start with change course. What does change course mean?
I think change course means to act upon the demands of the international community. I mean, I mentioned previously, we saw the United Nations Security Council pass a resolution last week, which the US did not veto, which was passed by a majority of the Security Council, in which an immediate ceasefire was called for. It also called for the immediate release of an unconditional release of all hostages, and we support that. Hamas should do that. That is a requirement for there to be any peace. And it required Israel to ensure humanitarian access to Gaza to address medical and humanitarian needs. Sorry, I should say it required all parties to enable a humanitarian access to address medical and humanitarian needs. So I would say that when I talk about changing course, I think first principles are to listen to the calls from the international community and to act accordingly.
I do want to ask you about other issues in foreign policy, but before we leave this, on the point of a ceasefire, how does it actually occur? There needs to be, things need to occur in sequence. Are we saying Israel needs to stop firing? Are we saying Hamas needs to first return the remaining hostages and give an undertaking about future attacks? How do we police such an undertaking? What are actually the steps to achieving ceasefire?
That's a good question, and actually touches upon a domestic point which I'd like to come back to, if I may. But first on that, obviously we are not the state. We are not the entity that is able to broker this. We gain some insight from how the previous ceasefire was agreed, which was a release of hostages in return for a ceasefire, an immediate humanitarian ceasefire and additional aid. Hamas releasing the hostages and the party ceasing combat and access for humanitarian aid and assistance are obviously the elements of an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. A longer process, both for sustainable ceasefire, which would require Hamas to have no role, and progress towards a two-state solution, are all required for peace. And the point I would make, because sometimes the debate here in Australia operates as if, you know, we can resolve this, our role in this is to use our diplomatic and political voice. That is what Australia can do. We are not a party to the conflict. We are not of the region, but we can work with others as we have to add weight to our diplomatic voice. And you've seen that with the Canada, Australia, New Zealand statements that we've been part of. You've seen that in the most recent statement with the United Kingdom. If you look at what we said there on the conflict, we are seeking to amplify our voice. My concern, if I can come to the domestic point, Karen.
Yeah.
I am very concerned about where we are here. One of the things I saw when I went to the Middle East and the comment I made to the people I was travelling with, you know, respect for the other's humanity is not something that we see enough of in the Middle East and in the context of this conflict. There's been a loss of respect for the other's humanity. And my great fear is, I think, some of the language here, some of the political tactics that people hear. We're seeing some who also lose respect for others' humanity. And I think I don't want the conflict, the language used here, to reproduce the conflict. And, you know, we see people who claim to represent one perspective who delegitimise the legitimacy or diminish the legitimacy of the other. And, you know, I just say this. It's not okay to blame anyone in Australia for the actions of the Netanyahu government, just as it's not okay to blame anyone in Australia for the actions of Hamas.
Well, I wanted to ask you about social cohesion and what are you saying is the connection here between political tactics, as you described them, and the situation the Prime Minister has alluded to, you have alluded to in Australia with, you know, a lot of people feel deeply affected by this, already did before this incident, perhaps even more now are focused on this whole situation, given what's happened to these aid workers. But we've seen hundreds of thousands of people affected prior to that. What is the connection between political tactics, as you put it, and social cohesion? And how can you address social cohesion in this country in relation to this issue?
Karen, I've been in Parliament 20 years and I have seen political tactics where division has been used for political benefit, right? I think where we are at the moment is probably the worst I've ever seen it. When you have a member of the Greens accusing the Prime Minister and I of facilitating the death of an aid worker because she doesn't agree with our position on Israel, I think that is beyond the pale. I do. I've been accused both of supporting genocide and of being anti-Semitic. Like, I don't think that language is conducive to social cohesion. It's not about me, but it's the tone of that debate. We have to remember that we're an incredibly diverse society and we have people, as you've often heard me say, Karen, from all over the world. We have hundreds of communities, hundreds of languages. One in two of us is either born overseas or is a parent born overseas. But we have managed through all of this to engage in our democracy and our community in a way that encompasses difference respectfully. Well, all of us have to try and do that in this debate. Like, you and I may not agree on this conflict, but how we deal with that matters for our democracy.
There's a lot more we could talk about in relation to this issue, but I do want to raise other things, so I'm going to move on. You've had a very busy time diplomatically in the last couple of weeks. You had a revolving door of visitors a couple of weeks ago here in Parliament. First of all, Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister. That's a really significant visit. With a couple of weeks passed since then, what do you think was achieved in terms of the relationship in that visit? We've seen a couple of changes in the economic domain since then, but what's been achieved bilaterally overall?
I think it's really important for us to continue to engage with China and to continue to have dialogue and to continue to work on those areas where we can cooperate, as well as being clear with each other where we don't agree. And the work of diplomacy is ongoing. The work of engagement, including economic engagement, you know, doesn't stop. And, you know, we need to keep that engagement going. And we've seen some benefits of that engagement. You know, obviously the wine decision was very welcome and we've seen a lot of trade impediments lifted. But more broadly, China's and Australia, neither of us are going anywhere and neither of us are going to change who we are. And both of those things mean that there are areas where we can cooperate, but there are always also areas where, because of who we are, we will have different views and we will have disagreements. Part of a responsible government's job is to try and manage that. So I was pleased that Foreign Minister Wang Yi came to Australia. I'd been to Beijing, so we were pleased that the Chinese minister came to Australia as part of the dialogue process. I went through transparently with Australians in my press conference the topics which were raised, including Dr. Yang, and the issues, obviously, which are of concern, as well as the issues where we can cooperate.
And do you feel like any of that was advanced, particularly in terms of Dr. Yang? Do we have to accept a lack of visibility on that?
Well, the Chinese political and legal system is a very different system to Australia's. But do I think the engagement is worthwhile? Yes, I do. And it is important.
You mentioned the wine decision. We've also had a bit of a setback with the World Trade Organization on steel. You know, it's a bit give and take, the economic relationship.
The steel decision was a domestic decision, let's be clear. Yes, I know it involved China, but it was a decision made for domestic policy and legal reasons.
I guess what I'm getting to is, how do we avoid this becoming sort of transactional, you know, the economic dimension of that relationship? It's complicated.
That's a good
question.
We know
it's complicated. Yeah. We don't want it to be binary. You've said you don't want it to be what you want people to understand. We're not going back to where it was. So how do we avoid it just becoming, you do this, I'll do this, or we want this, give us this. Well, we'll give you this.
We need to very clearly understand what our interests are. And, you know, that means that informs where we want to press very hard, where we will disagree, and areas where we think we can cooperate. And I think it does require an assessment by whoever's in government of what Australia's interests are. And sometimes there are things you have to weigh, but I've never been of the view, as obviously some in the previous government were, that disengagement was in Australia's interests, even when you don't agree.
I've got a couple of things I want to get, other things I want to get to in the time we've got left, but I just want to ask you a sort of slightly personal question, I suppose. You're of Malaysian Chinese heritage, and when we're talking about China in particularly, it's clear the Chinese place a lot of store on Chinese heritage. I was in China late last year before the Prime Minister arrived. I was there on a journalist exchange, and in one of the dialogues we had with some academics, it was specifically raised that you were of Chinese heritage, and it was raised as if that put you in some kind of, I don't know, higher expectations or something. And I just wonder, you've spoken about the modern multicultural Australia, and you are the example of that as our first Foreign Minister of Asian Heritage. But in particular in dealing with China, do you feel that your Chinese heritage makes any difference in engaging with China? You know, either, make it easier, make it harder, make any difference. Do they note that? Does it put extra pressure on you?
I think there's already enough pressure on me anyway.
Well, quite.
I think it gives me cultural reference points. It helps me because part of this job requires you to understand where the other is coming from, because your capacity to influence, to negotiate, to understand where people's red lines are, to understand where you might be able to shift them, needs you to be curious and thoughtful about where is the other person, the other nation, where is your counterpart coming from? How do they see the world? And that's imperfect, right, because, you know, I live in Adelaide and I've lived in Australia most of my life. And, yes, my father's of Chinese heritage, but we're Malaysian Chinese. So it's, a few generations before you go back, back to China. But it is important, I think, whether it's in the Pacific or in North Asia or Southeast Asia, to really listen and to really think carefully and be curious about where are they coming from, understand the world from where they see it. So I think sometimes it gives me reference points and an access. So that's probably what I notice. But, my dad might say I'm pretty westernised. So,
in the couple of minutes we've got left, because I've chewed up a lot of time here, you had the British Foreign Secretary and Defence Secretary here, and you mentioned the Pacific. Britain is now suddenly interested in the Pacific, which we haven't seen before. Is that also about China? And are we playing some kind of conduit role with some of our allies that are further afield with less direct connection in the Pacific in relation to that?
No, I don't think in the Pacific we're a conduit for anybody. We are a part of the Pacific Forum. We're part of the Pacific family, and we are an important part of development and security in the region. Yes, there are other partners. Obviously, Britain has an historical connection. And, you know, when the Queen passed away, I was struck by how many I think the Prime Minister offered transport for a number of, for Pacific Island Commonwealth countries or Pacific Island nations, and it really struck me how many leaders went because, you know, that history is still an important part of the Pacific. So, you know, Britain has a role to play and seeking to re-engage and obviously, or engage more deeply, I should say. And obviously CHOGM is going to be held in Samoa this year. So that's a Pacific Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. That's a big deal. And we want that to be a success. Samoa want that to be a success. And I know the United Kingdom too.
Quick domestic question. We've seen this back and forth over the detention legislation the government's trying to pass. And one aspect of that does sort of cross into your portfolio area in the sense that we're seeking to restrict visas from countries that won't take their citizens back under deportation arrangements that Australia wants in place. Does that create diplomatic problems? Like, is that a bad precedent to set to start using diplomatic relations for domestic political purposes here?
Look, I think it's about having a set of tools to manage borders in circumstances where some people are, you know, refusing to comply with a requirement to return. And remembering that we're not talking about refugees in any of these. This is all in relation to people who have been found not to be refugees. But what I said before was, look, I don't think this would operate as the first thing you did. You have a range of diplomatic tools. You engage with other countries about these issues at different levels. So I think the legislation looks to establish this power, but I wouldn't see that as the first thing you'd go to. And I would, the point I did make when I was asked about this previously is that, you know, there has to be consultation with the Prime Minister and the person in this role, the Foreign Minister, before a country would be listed in that way. So it's not simply a power of the Home Affairs Minister.
In the Senate, you're the leader in the Senate. We've seen another block in the Senate split with the Lambie group and Tammy Tyrrell. Does that make your negotiations on things like the immigration bill and other things in the Senate harder or easier now that there are even more independents in the Senate?
I've had this job a fair while, and my experience is, you know, you just have to deal with people as respectfully and transparently as you can, and be upfront when you can do something, be upfront when you can't. You know, you win some votes, you win don't win others. It's just how it is.
I don't think I've spoken to you, and I'll finish on this point. I don't think I've spoken to you since you got married. So I do want to also say congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And having spoken to you about this diplomatic flurry you've just been through, what were you thinking getting married the weekend before all of those meetings? And are you actually going to have a honeymoon? Like, what is going on with that?
I got one day, and then we had China and then the UK. In my defence, we had set the date well before these events had been set. So I had, in fact, before Parliament had been set. So I'd been hopeful we might not have a sitting of Parliament, but we had a sitting of Parliament. And then we had the confirmation for both the Chinese Foreign Minister and the British, you know, the United Kingdom's Defence and Foreign Secretaries. And obviously I had to be there, so I ended up having a day off. But hopefully we'll do something another time. But thank you for your good wishes. It's been really lovely how many people have sent us their best wishes, and Sophie and I really appreciate it.
And you played such a role in the marriage debate back in the day, which was so difficult. And if a wedding day can be any more wonderful, surely it must have been an extra moment of joy that you were able to do this in this country with the person that you love.
It was a wonderful day, a wonderful celebration, surrounded by people who love us and who we love, and I was really, really happy. I was really happy to do it. I have made the joke, because we've been together quite a long time, that actually we've been together about 17 years. I said for 10 of it, to be fair, it wasn't legal, so only 7 of the delay is on me.
And honeymoon sometime?
Well, we will think about that.
I hope you do. Look, I just want to thank you again for making the time in such a very busy time with so many difficult issues on the boil for speaking to us. We really appreciate it. Thanks very much, Minister.
No, good to be with you. Cheers.
This episode was produced by Alison Chan and Camilla Hannon. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.